And our last case for argument, United States versus Davis, Mr. Locker.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Bruce Loescher from Springfield, and I represent Benny Davis as appointed counsel. Benny was convicted of possession of cocaine with intent to deliver, which arose out of a search of Benny's home back in October of the year 2000. However, he wasn't charged until the year 2001 when he was indicted, which was more than a year after the search. This case is about drugs, but it's also about credibility. The government's evidence during this case was that in this search of Benny's home, in which they spent several hours, a large group of law enforcement officers, without anyone else present in the home, they found a quantity, I believe, approximately 12 grams of cocaine in a shoe at the rear of the home and laundry area, and another gram, it turns out later, in a safe that they found in a closet of the home and subsequently opened after it had been removed. This gram of cocaine was found squeezed between the door and the safe itself. They found three handguns in a closet, which had been purchased by the defendant. The search robber turned up nothing, none of the accoutrements of dealing in drugs, which you might expect to find, or cooking in drugs, as was some of the testimony in this case, other than some plastic bags that were found in the kitchen. Small plastic bags, but then the defendant was one who was involved in crafts. He was a craftsman. He was developed belts and so forth, and beaded belts, and these are the things that beads come in and so forth. So they found those plastic bags in the home. But the case involved, did Benny know that those drugs were there? He testified he didn't. He talked about the fact that there was $6,000 found in that safe, in addition to this small quantity of cocaine. Where did that $6,000 come from? The evidence was that Benny was always gainfully employed, if not at one, at two, and three jobs at the same time. So he earned money, plus the fact we know from the evidence that others with whom he worked contributed money toward a dream that they had, which was to get into the music business, into the recording business. They had their own music studio, and they developed CDs, hoping to strike it big there. And one of those witnesses that testified for the defense was Stacy Ware. And Stacy Ware talked about how they gave the money to Benny to hold for them. They used that money to pay bills and other things, but generally he was the treasurer for that dream that they had. And on his cross-examination, or the cross-examination of Mr. Ware, the government started asking him whether or not he used fake names, told him that he had been convicted of theft, larceny, all of which he denied. There was a series of questions set out in the brief. A series of questions was also asked of the defendant, Benny Davis, when he testified, accusing him of using a false name, incorrect date of birth, lied about being in the military, all of these things to a police officer. And the result was that, you know, you're waiting, the answers to all those questions were no. So you wait and feel, you know, see, I missed this, and when I talk with these witnesses before I put them on the stand, and waiting for the other shoe to drop, when the government gets to the rebuttal evidence, but there was no rebuttal evidence. But the bell had been rung, and that information, that thought placed in the jury's mind that, hey, the defense witnesses are, if not a thief, at least a liar, or liars, thieves and liars, in addition to probably being involved in the drug trade. We feel and suggest that that not proving the predicate offense, not completing the impeachment of these witnesses, denied Mr. Davis a fair trial.
Well, did you ask the judge to ask the government to substantiate the, you know, indicate the basis for the questions to these witnesses?
No, sir.
But without that, how can we review the issue? The government had a good faith basis for asking these impeaching questions, and there's no error.
Well, I dispute that. I dispute that they had a good faith.
Well, how do we know if they weren't asked to, you know, tell the judge what the basis for the questions was?
Well, you know, I was left with the point where, you know, the government didn't come back. The case was over. And no, I did not ask the court to have the government provide a basis for that information. I also didn't ask the court to declare a mistrial in that particular instance. But I think that because the issue of credibility is important here, that it is a factor upon which this court could find that the defendant was denied a fair trial and remand this case for a retrial. The other point I'm going to argue is that with regard to the voice print analysis. The government's case was based in part upon conversations that they had overheard involving Anthony Sistrunk, the half-brother of the defendant. Now, going back a little bit, the raid in October on Benny's house, supposedly they were raiding that because they thought it was a cache. It was the place where Sistrunk was holding his drugs. They were recording, had Boku phone conversations involving Sistrunk, and they had isolated some of these conversations and said that they involved conversations between Sistrunk and Benny Davis, my client. Benny and I listened to all of the tapes that were supposedly going to be used by the government in this case. And the Benny said, "No, it's not my voice. Not my voice." And so we asked the government to perform a voice print analysis on it. I didn't get an answer back right away. Didn't get an answer back. When I got the answer back that it was no, which was after they talked with Sistrunk, that's when I made the motion to have an expert appointed to do a voice print analysis on this.
Okay, running out of time here, but the problem I thought here was that $15,000 was a pretty deep number. Because Sistrunk said that was Benny that was in the conversation with him.
Yeah. Well, I had initially asked the government to submit it to their experts to do the analysis. There was precedent for that. There was precedent in Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Hartzler, and I had a case involving a phone threat against the president, actually the presidential candidate Bush. And when my client denied making that phone call, He gave voice exemplars, and they submitted that to their government expert. That was in March 2000 when the purported phone call was made.
But you can't require the government to do your create your evidence.
No, but I was looking toward the issue of the cost involved.
You'd have to pay if you didn't pay. It's not free.
Well, that may be, but I'm sure it would be quite a bit less. And it's a double-edged sword.
Why would it be less for the government than for you?
Pardon me?
Why would it be less for government? Why would the expert charge the government less?
I just figured it would when you start factoring in the fact that a witness would have to not only do the analysis, but do his reports, and then come down to testify. And this particular witness
was
from
Wisconsin. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lozman. Okay. Mr. Bass?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, with respect to the cross-examination issue, it's ironic that a counsel for a defendant would argue to you that the government failed to do something that the rule of evidence specifically forbids. That is, Mr. Loesch's argument is the government didn't prove up its cross-examination. Well, Rule 608B of the Rules of Evidence specifically forbid that for the purpose of not getting into collateral issues. And if the rules of appeal allowed me to tell you what my good faith basis was for asking those questions, I'd be glad to do it. But it's not in the record because of the fact that Mr. Loesch never challenged those questions in the first instance. Not only did he not challenge the questions by objecting, he never asserted any challenge to the good faith basis or factual predicate in asking them.
Well, there'd be some good reason not to challenge them to get into more detail, wouldn't there?
Well, Your Honor, there could be a basis for...
How do I know that's true? And then you come up with all sorts of things that show that it is, that it's a fact. Isn't that what would it be following if they challenged why you asked those questions and what the basis was?
Well, Your Honor, I think the proper course of action there would have been to ask for a sidebar and raise that challenge if there's a concern about doing that in the presence of the jury. But the real telling aspect of this objection, or the irony of the objection to these questions, is if you look at the other questions that I asked, at least of the defendant, which were not objected to, that being that he provided false names to law enforcement, and he admitted that fact to the magistrate judge. If Your Honor saw fit to listen to the recorded pretrial detention hearing, you will hear that this issue was raised before the magistrate judge when the government sought the defendant's detention. So it's ironic.
Well, we won't know whose voices we're listening to.
Well, Your Honor, I think you'd be able to tell that it's Mr. Loesch and mine and Magistrate Judge Cudmore's. But one of the bases for...
Not the voice prints.
Well, with respect to that, Your Honor, that issue is reviewed simply for abuse of discretion. And as this court has said in Cravens, in reviewing such a request, one of the factors is whether the request was timely. This case was indicted in November of 2001. Shortly thereafter, the recordings were made available to Mr. Loesch and the defendant. They continued to be available until March. And in March of 2001, 3 months, or 4 months before the trial, the government made available these recordings and also a paralegal to play those recordings to the defendant. Now, contrary to what Mr. Loesch has told you, I made it clear to him that from the very outset that there was no intention on part of the government to go to the expense or delay in submitting these recordings for voice analysis, simply because Mr. Davis denied that it was him on the tapes. The government had no doubt, based on its evidence, that it was him. This was his cell phone. The records of the defendant's cell phone found in his house reflected those calls. And we had a witness, his half-brother, who we expected to testify.
Was his name ever used in the calls?
The defendant's name, Your Honor?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. I believe if I'm not mistaken, Your Honor, that there may have been a reference to his nickname, but I may be incorrect on that. But there was no doubt on the part of the government that this was the defendant. And that was made clear to Mr. Loescher and the defendant. And as Judge Scott found in her order denying this motion, after three requests for continuances of the trial, and after a final firm trial date was set, it was only then that Mr. Loescher makes this request on the eve of trial. That fee request was excessive, as Judge Scott found, and it was untimely. And regardless of this assertion as to when the government informed the defendant that it did not intend to seek analysis, it doesn't explain the excessive nature or the untimely nature of the request. So, Your Honors, if there are no questions with respect to any of these issues, the government would ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to Mr. Loescher. Your time expired, and you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for accepting the appointment, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.